ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher Skase, young, handsome, entrepreneur. He finds epic success in the 80s.
He came with that cowboy energy. He was doing big things.
Skase becomes a media mogul.
He outbid the legendary Rupert Murdoch.
His empire teeters, but he outfoxes them all. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Meet the winner of the 2025 Prime Minister's Prize for Science. Her work, so brilliantly successful, is of benefit to everyone alive.
What motivates me every day is the utility of this knowledge to directly serve people. We all live on planet Earth. We all have but one life to live. Helping to keep this planet habitable with a clean atmosphere and indoor spaces filled with clean air is the foremost purpose and the aim of my scientific work.
Lidia Morovska, accepting the top prize this week in Canberra. Can you imagine anything more important than clean air to breathe without COVID germs or deadly chemical fumes or other stinking pestilence? The Science Show with a glimpse of the big night. And in a few minutes, the Prime Minister himself on why science is vital for the nation. I'm Robin Williams, and later on, another question to what have the Romans ever done for us? The answer, helping with the search for dark matter. But let's leap back to a science show in which I first met the distinguished professor from QUT. Here she is recounting her struggle to get people to accept her evidence that COVID was actually in the air we breathed.
Well, to me, it was very obvious that the virus is transmitted through the air because it comes from our nose, our mouth. It is in the air before it is anywhere else, on the surfaces or before it's on another person's face. However, at the time, the understanding of the medical community, and particularly related to the decision makers, was that the virus is only big particles which drop to the ground with, let's say, arm's length. That's been a medical dogma, in fact. If you are arm's length, you are safe. But there's been plenty of evidence that the virus is in the air everywhere in the space.
Which ones are carried by particles, actually, that we know about?
Well, they need particles because that's how they are generated. They are generated in our respiratory tract when air is traveling from the bronchial regions through the larynx and through the mouth. And in that process, particles are formed there, particles which consist of our respiratory liquids, and if the virus is there, or bacteria, any pathogen, it is in that particle.
And what was the reaction when you published your paper? What happened way back?
When our paper, which we call Open Letter, because this has been going for at least 3 months when we were trying to convince the WHO and other decision makers of the role of airborne transmission. So when it was published in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases and called this Open Letter to the WHO and the national decision makers, the next day the WHO acknowledged what they say emerging evidence. But this evidence was there for a very long time.
We are in a small room in QUT, the Queensland University of Technology, and there is a bit of air conditioning, but apart from that, the air is pretty static. And someone was in this room before a few minutes ago. Would her breath have remained, and if there were germs in it, would they still be infectious, do you think?
It very much depends on the ventilation here. And the fact that we can feel that there is some breeze here, we cannot tell how good the ventilation is. Unfortunately, I didn't bring my CO2 meter. I would have been able to answer that question, judging by the concentration of CO2. Now, we all exhale carbon dioxide all the time. So if carbon dioxide accumulates here in this room, the virus likely as well.
So there's huge response when people realise that you were right. And did they take action quickly enough?
The discussion is what is quickly enough in that sense. We are talking about a very big job to change how we operate buildings to improve ventilation. So this is not something which can be changed from one day to another. There is an attempt to do this, and that attempt is to tell us, open the window. Is there a window in this room? You just explained how that room looks, right? There are no windows in many modern buildings at all. And we don't know whether there are enough windows, let's say, in our schools, or whether the window opens. So just opening the window is not a solution. So really, it's a huge job ahead of us to change the way we design the buildings, such there's that enough ventilation, considering also many other aspects, in particular energy. We can't open that window and lose all the energy we invested into heating or cooling. So there's a lot of work to be done, but the most important is to change the regulations. Do you know that Australia doesn't have indoor air quality standards?
At all?
At all, at all.
And the winner of the 2025 Prime Minister's Prize for Science is Distinguished Professor Lydia Morawska.
And here she is this week.
Their control measures here are completely wrong. Remember, people in the supermarkets wearing gloves but not wearing masks. And this was so, it's just incredible for me. So that's when I decided something must be done about this, because otherwise it just costs lives.
And in the years, 4 years or so since, have things changed properly?
Things have changed, yes. It has been in general accepted within the medical community, within policymakers, that respiratory infections are airborne and control measures must include measures against what's in the air. So this has changed. But what hasn't yet changed is the general approach to indoor air quality, because this virus in the air is just one pollutant in the air. And one can say, okay, open up the building. If it has windows, it will go out, increase ventilation, whatever you do. But in the process of doing this, you may not realize that you worsened some other things. So you must look at indoor air quality and its complexity as one thing. And Australia, like most other countries, don't have indoor air quality performance standards. So in this room could be anything, and no one measures this. So that's where now...
It's still not.
The discussion is only starting now. So we have outdoor air quality standards. Every jurisdiction, every state has a network of outdoor monitoring stations. We can just check on the website and see what's air quality in where you are. But indoors, no one monitors at all what's indoors.
What would you need to do it? Would it be a very expensive machine or what?
No. The point is it will have to be done very differently. We have very expensive machines outdoors, but we cannot have very expensive machines indoors. But there are now technologies of low-cost sensors, low-cost monitors. I have one in my handbag here, this size. So it's not expensive at all. So we can now reliably monitor some pollutants in the air, not everything, but some pollutants in the air very cheaply and very reliably. But monitoring is one thing. Then this information about monitoring must go to some kind of data platform and decision platform, which will then inform the building management system what to do about keeping air quality. Technologically, it is all possible. There's not a big deal right now, but without standards, it's not going to happen.
But one thing that really strikes me, having been doing the science show for over 50 years, and that is, I go to QUT, the Queensland University of Technology, beautifully placed just beyond the Botanic Gardens, by the water, just delightful. And there I see you with a worldwide reputation, and I see David Flannery, who's also looking after the Mars Explorer for NASA, looking at it and telling it where to go, and the robots, which are famous. Now, you can go right round Australia and you will see science at that fantastic level. Do you think people are aware, for example, of what QUT stands for? You know, one of the great centres of science?
Well, I wouldn't think that people are sufficiently aware of what's happening at QUT. I would also wouldn't say that people are sufficiently aware of what science is doing and what science should and could do for us. Because really, the decisions we make about our planet, about how we live, what we do, should be based on science. So we need to source the reliable sources of science and then, based on the science, decide what to do. And society is not really aware of this.
And it would save them money and make their shopping and their health even better. So it's in their interests.
It's in their interest, because if you base it on what's right, which is science, then you save, this helps, and so on. Otherwise, you may do something which has nothing to do with your best interest.
Are you going to make use of the prize to go around the country telling them?
Well, definitely. I'm hoping that this prize will make my platform now louder to help changing things.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Distinguished Professor Lydia Morowska at Parliament House in Canberra. And here's some big news. In 2 or 3 weeks, those very new clean air technology she mentioned will be deployed for the first time at QUT, the Queensland University of Technology. And the world will see what can be done globally in applying science in the public interest. So you may ask, does the Prime Minister himself, Anthony Albanese, agree with Lydia's sentiments? Here he is at the ceremony.
Tonight is a chance to truly celebrate the achievements of individuals, but also to celebrate who we are as a nation. We are very good at celebrating our sports people and achievements in the arts. Today in Parliament, we had Missy Higgins come along and sing a few songs, and that is fantastic. But the work that you do lasts through the generations. And that is why recognising the success, recognising the inspiration, recognising as well the determination of not only the people in this room, but the network of researchers, innovators, teachers and academics that make up Australia's wonderful scientific community is so important. This year, like all years, it's been a good year for Australian science. Bigger than usual, though, because it's not every year that an Australian scientist is recognised with a Nobel Prize. I, of course, am speaking about Professor Richard Robson, a great Australian. And last month, along with two colleagues, Professor Robson became a Nobel laureate in chemistry for his work developing an entirely new form of molecular architecture called metal organic frameworks. Metal organic frameworks are tiny, amazing structures, literally molecule-sized. A teaspoon of these materials has the surface area of a football field. You can think of metal organic frameworks as tiny nets or bubbles that interact with matter at incredibly precise and minuscule levels. And although molecular in scale, the implications of Professor Robson's discovery for Australian industry and technology are absolutely massive. From collecting water from the air of arid environments to delivering precise medical treatments, removing carbon from the atmosphere, or storing and transporting hydrogen as an energy source. Professor Robson's research reveals new ways to tackle stubborn problems, and his achievement is the culmination of a 60-year career of scientific pursuit, of the distillation of his knowledge of trial, error, and indeed success. It deserves our congratulations and our deepest admiration. One of the things I was really pleased by was I gave a speech in the Parliament about the award, and it received an enormous number of likes. So what that said to me was that out there, there is a yearning for this amongst mainstream Australia, even those of us who it took me some time to say, what exactly has Professor Robson done and how does this work and why is it important? And I had someone who's smarter than me in my office was able to explain that to me. But it is a great thing that Australians, like we do in so many fields, punch above our weight, including in science. This new Australian Nobel Prize also represents a significant moment for the University of Melbourne, the Australian Research Council and the Australian Research Grants Committee, because these organisations have supported Professor Robson and his work for decades, making him the first Australian laureate to be recognised after receiving Australian public funding for his research. And their support is a reminder of the quiet, sustained way in which our public research institutions contribute not just to the life of our nation, but indeed to the whole world. Their investment in science, what it brings us and how it shapes our world, is immensely valuable, not just to Australian researchers, but to all of us as Australian citizens. Tonight also marks another significant milestone in the scientific life of our nation. For the first time, the Prime Minister's prizes for science includes the inaugural prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge systems. It is a worthy and important change. Over the span of thousands of generations, First Nations Australians have cultivated a unique connection to this land, an intimate wisdom passed on through deep time. And through this connection, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have created their own detailed knowledge of meteorology, astronomy, horticulture, biology. For the longest time, much of this knowledge went unseen and unconsidered by mainstream science. Yet just as embracing the world's oldest continuous culture has enriched our understanding of our history, understanding Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander science allows us to see things that we might otherwise have missed, shedding new light on problems, making fresh connections across disciplines, and deepening our collective knowledge of our home continent and the world around us. And this is surely what lies at the heart of science. Pursuing curiosity, looking at a problem through a different lens or applying a new expertise, and therefore expanding the realm of the possible to come to a new or improved hypothesis. It is that valuable contribution to building on the Australian scientific project that is reflected in the Prime Minister's Prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge systems. My government will always champion Australian science. I'm proud that I attend the meetings of the committee that I have the honour of chair, every single one. I haven't missed one, and we're meeting again on Wednesday with the Chief Scientist and his team. It matters. We know Australian science is a key driver of our economy now and will continue to be. Whether it's harnessing the power of AI, generating and storing renewable energy, improving the way we grow our food or treat illness, or quantum computing, looking at the next few decades, it is Australian science that has so much to contribute to the world that we know is just around the corner. Of course, we face a changing world. Increasingly, Australian challenges are also global ones. This makes the impact of those challenges more acute, and also makes them more difficult to solve. We know, because the science tells us, that climate change is happening, and that we are feeling the effects of climate change. Our government has an ambitious and achievable plan to get us to 62 to 70% lower emissions by 2035 and then to net zero by 2050. But the fact that some question the science reiterates to us that we have a responsibility to continue to argue the case, to not assume that facts are understood. And we have a responsibility to the people, not so much people in this room, but to my son and your sons and daughters and their sons and daughters and their sons and daughters, to act in a way that stresses the urgency which is required from the challenge, but also the opportunity through the use of science to find ways that alleviate the challenge but create actually greater economic prosperity by seizing those opportunities which are there. It is not either or, It is both, if we are smart and if we embrace science rather than embrace a flat earth position that it is not real. Sometimes I cut through. I'm amazed that there's still a debate. We are investing in the National Reconstruction Fund and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation to boost renewables and low carbon industry. And the Denham Review into our research and development performance is focused on harnessing Australian R&D to power economic growth and boost our industry at home. Australian science is at the centre of all this. Our technology, our research, and importantly, our teachers, educating and inspiring our next generations with that spark of scientific curiosity. As we look ahead, it is the work of the people in this room who will put Australia in the best possible position to seize those opportunities that are right in front of us. Tonight's an opportunity to reflect on the achievements of those Australians who work diligently in universities, in schools, in labs, or out in the bush, or on our coastlines, devoting their lives to curiosity and the discovery and teaching of science for the benefit of all Australians. Your commitment to science is well worth celebrating. In your pursuit of excellence, you help to drive our nation. You add to what and who we are, and you expand the realm of what is possible. And on behalf of the Australian Government, I say thank you.
Thank you, Prime Minister.
This is the Science Show on Radio National at Parliament House in Canberra with this week's presentation of the Prime Minister's Prizes for Science.
Now, it is time for the inaugural presentation of the Prime Minister's Prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Knowledge Systems. This prize recognises an Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander-led project that benefits Indigenous peoples, communities or place, and contributes to solving a significant challenge through the practice and preservation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge systems. Prime Minister, would you kindly please announce the inaugural recipient of this prize?
Thank you. Well, I'm particularly proud of the opportunity to be Prime Minister, announcing the first ever Prime Minister's Prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Knowledge Systems. And the winner, the inaugural winner for 2025 is Professor Michael Weir.
We're saltwater people. We live by the ocean. We have saltwater in our blood. As Mulgana people, we're on a mission to look after country and make sure country looks after us.
I'm Professor Michael. And now I'm with Michael Weir of Murdoch University in Perth and his Tidal Moon T-shirt.
Tell me the story about what happened in Shark Bay and how you had to repair so much.
Oh, well, the heat wave happened in 2011, 2012. And what we wanted to do is bring our Indigenous knowledge to a solution on how to restore seagrass. And we saw a symbiotic relationship between sea cucumbers and seagrass. And we used that relationship to not only develop a method, but also as a commodity to create human capital amongst our Indigenous people so they have the necessary skills to do seagrass restoration and also transfer those skills on to the next generation.
Seagrass, of course, is absorbing more carbon dioxide, 10 times more than tropical rainforests. It's amazing stuff. And was the heat depleting it?
Well, it's more that the seagrass has captured all the carbon in the sediment. So there's ancient carbon beneath the seafloor, and the seagrass keeps that in. So it's more avoiding more release of carbon than anything. So it's great to have the seagrass being relocated and put back in the seafloor and having the whole system work with carbon coming out of the atmosphere, going back in. But at the same time, we already have carbon there. So why not to avoid more devastation and restore seagrass where there is at risk of carbon?
Please explain sea cucumber. Now, it is not a plant.
It's not a plant. It's a little animal that sits on the bottom of the ocean. No eyes, no fins, no feet, no nothing. But they have an important role because they're nutrient cyclists. It's also the first trade. So prior to colonization, we used to trade with Macassans. And I think it's very good for reconciliation if you recreate that trade, bring it to a post-colonized world and show that we had small business and we had a system in place which everyone can relate to because small businesses run Australia. Mm. Why not recreate the first and show people that, hey, outside of all the politics, we can do the thing that everyone does on a day-to-day basis.
Trading with Macassans, now that's quite a long distance. How did you manage in the old days to do the conveyance?
Well, it wasn't people from Shark Bay. It was everyone from Arnhem Land and Kimberley. They took sea cucumbers and we received iron and other raw materials. Because they didn't have access up into Kimberley and Arnhem Land, I wanted to do it in Shark Bay because I had the opportunity to gain access into that market.
What did they say in the citation about giving you this first prize?
So what I thought was the best thing is very humbled. And I can remember when the girls told me from the PM's office or PM's prize office, I said, this is great. I'm glad I'm the first, but I definitely don't want to be the last. So tell me what I can do to make this thing going, and I'm happy to accept it, but I want to make sure we keep it going for the next 50 years, if possible.
When you're teaching at Murdoch University, do you find you have to be fairly careful putting the standard Western science together with traditional?
I think what we're doing at Murdoch University, we haven't actually started teaching because we're creating this practice of what seagrass restoration looks like with Western science and Indigenous knowledge. I think it's going to take about 2 years before we get to that stage. But in that 2 years, it's going to be exciting because I get to work with not only the university, I get to work with all the faculty and the students up in Shark Bay, in the water, showing them what we do and actually have more connection with how everything works, but do it in a Western science and Indigenous knowledge collaboration.
It's so impressive that it's in Western Australia, although it's a huge, huge state. But you've got so many examples of this collaboration between the two, or if you like, three cultures, from way up in the north and in Albany, the former head of the Kew Gardens, going with Aboriginal women to study the ways in which you can control fire in different places, the landscape. And so it goes on right across that huge state.
I think it's amazing, like, honestly. But I'm always constantly thinking about the people that come after us. So you got to do something. You have to keep moving forward and don't stop. If it's positive, it's moving in the right direction, you're working, you're including everyone, there's no harm, there's only positive that comes out of it.
And what do you call Shark Bay?
What I call Shark Bay? Home. It's very simple. It's my home. But
I mean the name.
It's Gadigal. It's it means two waters, or twin waters. There's two bays, but I just call it home. Everyone.
And is it thriving now?
It is fragile, but it also can be resilient. But people have to be included as a part of the environment.
Of course they do. And how do you spark that interest? How do you lead it?
With great difficulty, but I'm getting there. No. Spark interest is through work ethic. Everything's built on merit. So when merit meets opportunity, you have a good calculation for something great coming out of it. And I think that's what we've done. We've built everything on merit, and we're hoping that the opportunity will scale pretty soon.
And what about your own training as, if you like, a conventional scientist? What did you study?
Life studies, learned from my elders, people. They're the best things I've learned in life. Like yourself, you've been on the radio for 50 years. That's amazing. You have so much knowledge. You've done a lot. If I could sit with you for like 2 hours, I'm sure I'll learn something. But I think people need to learn from other people because we're all unique in our own different way.
Tradition of collaboration and cooperation. You can't do science without it, can you?
That's exactly right. And you can't do it without knowing who you're working with. You can't do it without connecting. You have to put it into practice.
Come and see you in Murdoch University.
Now you can come and see me in Shark Bay when you're ready. But it's been a pleasure and thank you so much for the time.
Michael Ware, the first winner of the Prime Minister's Prize for Indigenous Science.
Now, Prime Minister, please announce this year's recipient of the Prime Minister's Prize for Excellence in Science Teaching in Secondary Schools.
Okay, thank you. Well, the recipient of the 2025 Prime Minister's Prize for Excellence in Science Teaching in Secondary Schools is Mr. Matthew Dodds.
What is your school like? Describe it. Where is it?
It's a pretty unique school. It's very high in elevation, over 1,100 metres, up in Glen Innes, far north New South Wales. a bit fresh in winter if you've ever visited, but it's an enjoyable place to work. The school's located centrally in town, so a lot of the students walk to school. And in summer, it's beautiful. But if you visit in winter, there could be snow.
Even that far north?
Yes, surprisingly, even that far north, there are a few very, very fresh days that we have.
And how come that place in the country has become a centre for scientific ideas and teaching?
I've always been attracted to teaching in a rural area. I grew up in the Blue Mountains before it was as busy as it is now. And I had the opportunity to go on an excursion from the Department of Education called Beyond the Line, which advertises teaching in a rural area. And so if you can imagine 60 young university graduates jumping on a bus at Central Station, and they took us to Tamworth, and we just got to see, you know, what teaching was like in a rural area. And I thought, you know, this is pretty cool, you know, big wide open spaces, kids that were keen to have the opportunity to learn. As soon as I finished my degree, I moved there up to Tamworth and taught there for a while before moving a bit further north to the cold country, Glen Innes, with beautiful dark skies, which is great. Do a lot of stargazing and astrophotography. So, you know, it's a great town. You see your kids very often. You go to the shops, they're there. You go somewhere else, they're there. It's very good.
It's different here, and that's the point. And also the point you make about in the regions. You say, why should there be brilliant science going on in the country? Well, okay, it's not that remote. It's because you are surrounded by amazing natural stories to investigate. And the young people recognise that, do they?
Yes, I think they do, especially when you pointed out that if you bring up a light map of Australia, a light pollution map, and then you compare it to the rest of the world, you know, as you said, students can walk outside at night if they live in a rural town, look up and see something that's actually quite unique. See the beautiful Milky Way? I take students actually on excursion from Glen Innes to Siding Spring Observatory. It's an excursion I'm quite proud of. It gets a lot of schools from the region involved. It doesn't cost any money for any of the schools. And we travel to the observatory for a two-day program. And part of that program is stargazing and just walking outside. And I tell them the best stargazing you can do is just with your naked eye, just looking up and just taking it in. I don't think kids these days camp as much as they used to. I grew up camping in the Blue Mountains. So yeah, pointing that out to them, and then they realise in regional areas, that's an asset they have, which is cool, yeah.
Warrumbungle Ranges, one of the most ancient mountain ranges in the world. That's where the telescope was put up, the Anglo-Australian telescope. And when you are talking to young people, how is it that you manage to single out, as you have done, the young women sparking their interest? How did that happen?
I was inspired by my high school physics teacher, Jackie Tenner, who was an amazing physicist. And then I noticed I got taught by this amazing female physics teacher, and yet in the class there wasn't many female physicists or female students. And then I had a look back at the average over the last 10 years, and it was pretty bad. It was 1.1 students. I realised that, you know, nothing's going to change unless I do something. And so I had this phenomenal student, which a lot of students at the school knew about. She was the school captain, and she also did physics. And I went to the year 10 girls, and I said, just to let you know, if you like mathematics and you're good at it, you can do physics. You know, there's nothing stopping you. And Charlotte's doing physics right now, and she is smashing it. And a lot of these girls looked up Charlotte as a bit of a role model, as she is. And I said to them, look, you can sign up for physics, and if you don't like it, you can change out of it. A pretty amazing moment was the first assessment task the girls did in year 11, and the top 8 places in the task were girls. And I actually held the boys back after class. I said, boys, you're making me look bad. You're in the same class. There's nothing different that I'm doing. And so it's just amazing to see the numbers increase. And next year, I'm happy to report that the numbers are staying high as well. I've checked the numbers out, and we've also got the same large group of girls entering it, which is great as well, because it's strange if you're doing a course and you're the only person from your particular group, whether it's male versus female or ethnicities, you know, it's a little bit isolating. And so to build a core culture of, yes, girls can do physics and they smash it. I got to meet one of my heroes a while back in Sydney, Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell, and I got a photo with her. And I've got that photo up in the classroom. And so when I'm talking about physics, I'm not just talking about Newton and Galileo. I've got a series of 20 posters of famous female physicists, and she's one of them. And as I said, next to that poster is my photo with her. And I'm like, yes, you know, and I tell her story. And it gets the students excited.
She's been on the Science Show a few times, and she has, of course, the wonderful record of pulsar discovery, those amazingly dense bodies in space that go whizzing round. And may I ask you, finally, when you go on these excursions, the problem, the bane for many of the teachers is, you know, filling in all the forms, getting permission, getting the insurance, all that sort of paperwork stuff. How do you manage to do that yourself and teach at the same time?
Yeah, it does take time and it is difficult. And I help the other teachers because every teacher from every school has to do their own risk assessment. So I generate mine, then I show them mine and I said, you can use this as a template. It's also the case that once you've done it once for one particular site, like the observatory, you can then use that again the next year, make any modifications necessary. And a very big thank you to the observatory staff. They accommodate us, they look after us, they help us with our risk assessment. ANU sponsored the excursion, which was fantastic. As I said at the start, no cost to any of these schools from regional New South Wales to attend the observatory for a two-day excursion, which was cool.
Matt, if I can call you Matt, thank you so much, and an inspiration. I can see why you won the prize.
Thank you very much, Robin. Great to meet you.
Matthew Dodds from Glen Innes High School, New South Wales. And in a couple of minutes, our own Shelby Trainer will take you on an excursion to a cosmic observatory. But here's one more science star at Parliament House. In fact, a superstar, a former PM winner, Graham Farquhar, who, as I told the Prime Minister himself, has just been given a Nobel Prize equivalent in his field of environmental research. It is the Royal Society Medal, shared with his colleague, Suzanne von Kammerer. And here he is.
Graham Farquhar, Professor of Environmental Biology at the Australian National University. Retired.
Retired, yes, but you have just won an award which some people said is the equivalent, if you like, physiologically, of a Nobel Prize. What is it called, this award?
It's called the Royal Medal. Well, we haven't actually got it yet because the medal hasn't been finished.
But you did go over and you did have, was it lunch or dinner with the King?
No, the King had to go to the Vatican. So everything has been postponed, and I guess we'll go back again next year. But we did have a wonderful meal hosted by the Royal Society, the President and so on.
What's it equivalent to? Now, don't be modest, because I was told by some of your colleagues that it's of Nobel Prize level.
Well, certainly the list of people who've won looks similar to a list of senior winners.
Yes, but you've got it coming up. Will you have to go to England, and will it come from King Charles?
I think we'll go back again. It's quite expensive going to meet the King. King Charles has been a very consistent supporter of work done for looking after the environment, and so I have no hesitation in supporting.
Well, relishing the achievements of Australian scientists, especially when they're global ones, is something that we always like to encourage. So will you keep us in touch with what happens next and when they're finished printing the medal?
Surely, Robin, that's very kind of you.
Well, I do hope Graham Farquhar and Professor Suzanne von Kammerer get their Royal Medal one day soon. Graham is a previous winner of the Prime Minister's top prize, that was in 2015, plus the Kyoto Prize and a dozen others. Just look up the list and his amazing work. And now, inspired by teacher Matt Dodd's example, let's end this science show with a tour of the cosmos and answer that Life of Brian Monty Python question, what have the Romans ever done for us or our astronomers? Shelby Trainer reports.
30 years ago, scuba divers near the coast of Sardinia were just doing some kind of excursion in the sea, and they found the remaining of a Roman boat.
This boat would have sunk about 2,000 years ago, when the Roman Empire was thriving. It was full of lead ingots, each weighing over 30 kilograms.
To be used for the pipes of the Roman aqueduct and to build bullets used by the soldiers of the Roman army.
The shipwreck made headlines and ended up catching the attention of an Italian particle physicist.
He read this in the newspaper and had this idea that maybe this lead was what he was looking for.
You see, particle physicists are working at the very edge of what's known, in hopes of detecting something we've suspected, but never actually observed.
As a particle physicist, that's what you want to do. You want to go and push into space where no one has tested.
And that requires incredibly sensitive experiments, often deep underground, that need to be shielded from the elements. And sometimes the ideal candidate for that shield is a historical artifact.
Ancient lead, which has been underwater for many hundreds of years.
The use of this lead in physics experiments has brought about unusual collaborations and sparked heated debates about whether we should be destroying our history to advance science. Our understanding of the universe is at stake here, because one of the things these supersensitive experiments are looking for is dark matter. And if we can't find it, we have to rethink our fundamental laws of physics.
It's just this really big problem. We don't know what 85% of the matter in our universe is made out of.
Dr. Teresa Fruth has spent most of her career looking for dark matter, more recently at the University of Sydney. But what is dark matter? It's a hard question to answer. It's not ordinary matter. It doesn't interact with light, which means we can't see it. So how do we know it's there? Well, we don't know. We just strongly suspect.
So on the Earth, we just stay on the floor and we don't fly away because there is the attraction of the planet that keeps us stick to the Earth, let's say.
This is Dr. Paolo Gola from the National Institute for Nuclear Physics in Italy. He's describing the gravitational effect that not only keeps us stuck on the surface of the Earth, but also gives the universe its structure.
But in the universe, we see a lot of effects which point to the presence of a lot of material, a lot of stars, planets, galaxies. But we don't see these galaxies. Like there is an extra material, we don't know what it is. And this is what scientists call dark matter. So something that is out there in the universe and we don't actually see.
Dark matter is often referred to as a gravitational scaffold because while it doesn't interact with light, it does have mass. So it has a gravitational effect on the space around it.
So really it's a missing mass problem. We know there's a lot of mass out there. We don't know what it's made out of. We can't see it. We just can see its effects on the surrounding matter.
Without dark matter, the universe as we know it wouldn't even exist. It's believed that after the Big Bang, dark matter clumped together to create wells of gravity. Ordinary matter fell into those wells, mingled for a few million years, and became stars and galaxies. We're not sure how those would have formed without dark matter. But again, what is dark matter? We have all this indirect evidence that it exists, but we've never directly detected it to narrow down its properties.
What we're looking for in direct detection, we're building experiments on Earth, and we're looking for dark matter to interact with the ordinary matter we all know about. So in particular, often what we're looking for is a dark matter particle scattering off an atomic nucleus, which is basically like a billiard ball type of interactions, two things scattering off each other.
Even direct detection of dark matter is in some ways an indirect exercise. We're hoping to catch it in the act of bumping up against something very tiny. But this would be rare. Blink and you'll miss it.
If this interaction happens more often, we would have found it by now.
There are many different experiments looking for different interactions in different ways. But an example, Dr. Fruth has been working on the LZ experiment in the US, which has been looking for these billiard ball moments.
We have a big bucket filled with 7 tons of liquid xenon. When we have an interaction in this xenon, we get a flash of light. And that's at the few photon level, so you would not be able to see it with your eyes. And that's why we have almost 500 light detectors, which all could detect a single photon.
It's so interesting that it's dark matter and you may detect it because you spot some photons, like you spot some light.
Right. You just need to make it create light.
So the LZ team is waiting for a dark matter particle to bump up against the liquid xenon and let there be light. It's similar to the experiment Dr. Gawler has been working on in Italy, but instead of looking for tiny flashes of light, he's looking for tiny traces of heat.
The big project is named QORE, so QORE stands for Cryogenic Observatory for Radar Events.
This QORE detector is kept inside huge refrigerators
that are able to cool down something to few thousand of a degree above the absolute zero. It's some place that is colder than the outer space. As far as we know, it's probably one of the coldest places in the whole universe.
And because it's so cold, even the smallest particles passing through will cause the temperature within the detector to rise. These are the kinds of techniques needed to detect elementary particles or to observe rare events.
We cannot see the particles. So the way we have to look at particles is different to the way we look at things with our eyes.
Especially because at the level of elementary particles, it's really, really hard to see clearly. You might not know this, but right now you're being rained on by showers of cosmic rays.
These are basically protons flying in the universe, and they eventually hit the atmosphere of the Earth and generate showers of particles.
Here on the Earth, these cosmic rays aren't dangerous.
But if you want to build a very precise particle detector, the fact that it's continuously crossed by all these particles coming from the sky, it's a problem.
Which is why the Quarry experiment is in a laboratory underneath the Apennine mountain range.
The mountain acts as a shield, so stops all this particle coming from the universe and gives us some kind of cosmic silence where we can operate our detectors.
But even that is not enough. So you have your cavern deep underground, but then something that's actually such a big focus and we spend so much time on is really the low radioactivity material. So we just need to select everything.
Dr. Fruth is talking about the material of the detector itself, everything from the container to the nuts and bolts and sensors required to pick up a signal.
What we do is have material selection campaigns before we build the detector, where we screen a lot of those materials to look for trace radioactivity. It's kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack. You really have to get rid of all the hay so you can find the needle.
But the needle, you can't see it. It's invisible. Right. It doesn't interact with light.
Yeah, but hopefully with our detector.
We try to reach levels of purity, of silence, so low that the presence of a human being around the experiment or just the rock of the mountain or even the banana maybe that I bring to it in a break during my activity can be a source of contaminations that can disturb the experiment.
And so this is why just screening the material in the detector isn't enough. Layers of protective shields are necessary for the experiment to reach complete silence.
To doing this, we use different kind of materials to stop different kind of particles.
Which brings us back to the ancient Roman lead and why that particle physicist perked up when he saw a headline about a shipwreck.
Lead is a perfect material to make shields because it's very dense.
But there's an issue. Freshly mined lead naturally contains a trace amount of a radioactive isotope, lead-210.
So I build a lead shield to stop the particles, but the shield itself generates other particles that disturb the experiment.
This lead-210 can take a few hundred years to completely decay. So, after 2,000 years under the sea, it would be the perfect shield for the Quarry experiment. The physicist who saw the news about the shipwreck, the late Ettore Farini, understood the opportunity before him. This lead had been mined and refined so long ago that its radioactive component would have completely decayed.
He was able to build up an agreement among the cultural heritage of Sardinia, and some 100 bricks were given to the Institute of Nuclear Physics to build the shields of the experiment.
In this instance, the physicist worked with archaeologists to properly recover and document the items from the shipwreck. But this isn't the first time physics has benefited from a shipwreck. And in the past, scientists have gotten into hot water for buying lead from private companies that didn't follow archaeological standards.
Long time ago, I think 15 years ago, I went to a conference.
Dr. Elena Perez Alvero is an expert in underwater cultural heritage. After she spoke at this conference, a physicist pulled her aside.
She came to me and she said, "That's funny enough because we are using some ancient lead to do our experiments."
Dr. Perez Alvero immediately recognized this was a dilemma, whether we should destroy historical artifacts to build experiments. And there was no right or wrong answer.
It's not that easy. Ancient lead is being used for dark matter research, but it's also being used for medicine research. When I have a presentation on this, I always ask, where and when do you put the limit to use this?
When her work got media attention, she followed the audience comments closely. She called it a kind of war between those defending the past and those defending the future.
I don't think it's that clear, really. I don't think it's so white and black.
Regardless of how they end up being used, she says the lead ingots need to be handled like any other historical artifact.
Everything that is taken out of the water without a proper archaeological record, we will never have that information back. Where the ship was coming from, where was it going? And this is basic to understand the past and the history that we all love.
The quarry team still has a few lead bricks in their original form. And because they worked directly with the archaeologists, they understood the historical value.
Something very amazing is that the companies that extracted the bricks from the mine, not to get confused from one another who was the owner, they stamped the brand of the company on top of the bricks. You can read on top of the bricks this in Latin, name of the company that built the bricks.
This is the part of the brick that gets handed over to the archaeologists.
And then the remaining part of the bricks is melted and built in the correct shape to make a shield for the experiment.
And Dr. Perez Alvero makes the case for taking this approach, documenting the historical value first, of course, but then shaping the lead ingots into something new that can continue to contribute value to humankind.
We also have to consider that sometimes it's not used to have 1,000 ingots in the warehouse of a museum, because nobody's going to be able to see them. Nobody's going to be able to do anything with them because nobody wants to see 1,000 ingots in a museum.
While the physicists were gifted these lead ingots, they were able to give back to the cultural heritage officials as well, using their own techniques to uncover important historical information.
They were able to measure the contaminants in this lead in a way that these contaminants you find inside are like an ID card of the mine where this lead was extracted. So I really like that there was like mutual exchange of know-how among history and cultural heritage study and physics, which was something I completely didn't expect when I started this work.
I do wonder how long it would take to explain all of this to a Roman who 2,000 years ago set off in a ship full of lead ingots bound for home. And now that lead is underneath a mountain in Italy, shielding a physics experiment that could teach us about the even more distant past.
And nowadays we can easily tell that without this quality of the shield, we would have not been able to measure at the level we are measuring right now. So it was extremely successful in some way, the use of this material.
In a way, these high-tech, high-price-tag physics experiments serve the same purpose as an archaeological dig. We're trying to find out how we got here.
Without dark matter, probably we wouldn't be here today because structure wouldn't have formed as it did. And understanding that will just help us understand the world a little bit better. And I like to think maybe we'll understand our place within it a little bit better as well.
That report by Shelby Traynor, whom you can hear on the Health Report and What's That Rash? Next time on The Science Show, more Prime Minister's Prizes and the Bragg Prizes for Science Writing. A most unusual winner too. Production as ever by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.